It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.
Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scrovan, along with my co-host David Feldman. Hello, David.
Good morning.
And the man of the hour, Ralph Nader.
Hello, everybody. This is really a special program among special programs on infectious generosity.
That's right, Ralph. These last few years, we've all learned how easily infections can spread from person to person. But not all infectious things are bad. Laughter and yawning, to name just a few I can think of. And according to Chris Anderson, we can add the concept of generosity to that list. Mr. Anderson is a curator of TED, a nonprofit devoted to sharing valuable ideas, primarily through the medium of TED Talks, short talks that are offered free online to a global audience. In his new book, Infectious Generosity, The Ultimate Idea Worth Spreading, he prompts readers to ask themselves, am I a net giver or a net taker? And outlines how we can reclaim the internet as an amplifier of kindness. We'll speak to Chris Anderson about why he thinks infectious generosity's time has come, how everyone can play a part, and what the world will look like with generosity at its center. As always, somewhere along the line, we'll check in with our relentless corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokyber. But first, let's catch something good for a change. David?
Chris Anderson is the founder of the Sapling Foundation and curator of TED, a nonprofit devoted to sharing valuable ideas, primarily through the medium of TED Talks, short talks that are offered free online to a global audience. He is the author of Infectious Generosity, The Ultimate Idea Worth Spreading. Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Chris Anderson.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Welcome indeed, Chris. Well, listeners should know that this book takes the concept of philanthropy to a much higher level than any book I've ever read on the subject. And it's very practical. And not only does he talk about it in terms of the intangible rewards of being generous, but he's actually done it in terms of supporting major projects, having raised over $1 billion for these nonprofit projects just in the year 2023. And he also has an analysis of how it can be done locally with your own local projects. And who hasn't wondered how to raise more money for charitable and justice nonprofit efforts in their community? So listen carefully. The website is infectiousgenerosity.org. And we're going to talk about what he has established and called the Audacity Project. Chris, let's just start with, why did you write this book, since there's been so much exhortation books on philanthropy over the years?
Well, thank you for that. I'm really worried about how mean the world is. It seems to be mean and getting meaner. And the book is a response to that, I think. It's about generosity in all its forms, actually. Financial is maybe the most important, but there's actually so many ways to be generous. And in the connected world, just acts of human kindness and sharing stories of human generosity can help transform the culture, I think. We've somehow convinced ourselves that humans are pretty awful, and especially those other humans over there are really awful and scary, and we don't want anything to do with them. And this is really dangerous, because we're taking away what I think is humanity's superpower, which is the ability for very, very different people to connect and to negotiate and to agree and to find ways of cooperating. And so a lot of the underlying forms of generosity that I was interested in starting with, if you like, are just acts of paying attention to other people, to listening to other people with respect, to being willing to offer time, to be willing to share stories that spread kindness, to be willing to share knowledge and beauty and all of these other things, which in the connected age can fly across the world to an unlimited number of people. I mean, in principle, Ralph, all of the pieces are in place for this to be an age of generosity like no other, because the things that matter a lot to us, any product of the human mind, can be shared right across the planet to an indefinite number of people at no cost. This is astonishing. But we're not making use of that in the way that we should. We're actually using that same infrastructure to spread nastiness. So So that was the start point of the book, is how do you push back against that? How do we reclaim the internet, reclaim our connected age for the sharing of good things, not just ugly things?
Well, before we get into the actual projects, you talk about scale. And in your book, you say business operates at a scale that is at least an order of magnitude higher than philanthropy. Well, that means 10 times higher. But I'm sure you've seen situations where civic groups up against business opponents on issues like environment, consumer protection, worker protection, taxation. They're outnumbered maybe 100 to 1 or 1,000 to 1 in terms of resources, in terms of staff and other material support for their causes. And you say, why is this? And you answer it this way, quote, is it because somehow nonprofit initiatives can't scale? That it's actually appropriate for the majority of philanthropic efforts to be relatively small? No, I believe passionately we are woefully underestimating what nonprofits could achieve if given a chance. One of the problems that the nonprofit world lacks the funding opportunities created by the business world. How would you scale up?
Yeah, so this is indeed a giant problem. If you compare the journey that a business entrepreneur has to take versus a social entrepreneur, they are dramatically different in the world that we're in. A business entrepreneur, I mean, it's hard for anyone to raise money, but a business entrepreneur does have access to venture capitalists who are essentially sources of pooled capital. Many, many investors pool their capital, which allows venture capitalists to make big bets on entrepreneurs. Business entrepreneurs can eventually have access to an initial public offering and on a single day bring in tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars from financial investors that may make it unnecessary for them ever to have to raise capital again. They can just go out and build their company. There are no equivalents to these things on the nonprofit side. The life of a typical social entrepreneur or someone trying to raise money for a charitable cause typically has to spend meeting after meeting just grinding it out with one donor at a time and trying to persuade them, please, to consider contributing something. And there's a terrible unintended consequence of this. I mean, quite apart from the fact that we're asking the people who I view as some of the world's greatest heroes, the people willing to actually devote their lives to a cause bigger than they are, to making change in the world, we ask them to spend half of their time just grinding it out, raising money. That can't be right there. But I mean, secondly, it means that people cut back on their dreams. I mean, they're kind of forced to. Instead of raising money for the big dream that you could do, you raise enough that you could maybe get from a single donor. And so much of the nonprofit world feels underloved, I would say. It's a struggle for so many people in that space to achieve what they could achieve. That is crazy. It's wrong, because it just isn't the case that the majority of humanity's toughest challenges can be solved by the marketplace. I'm a capitalist. I believe in the power of capitalism, and I think it's done an amazing job of spreading ideas and building a lot of the world around us. But there are so many problems that it doesn't solve, and indeed that it has caused, that require a whole different mindset. We are not supporting the people willing to do that work in the way that we should.
Well, in response, you started with others the Audacious Project. And this is, listeners, what I want you to pay specific attention to, especially if you're involved in nonprofit civic activity in your community or state, nation, or world. And this Audacious Project, you say, brings together a group of visionary foundations led by TED, that's the TED Talk group, and the Bridgespan Group, an organization devoted to catalyzing bold philanthropy, end quote.
Here's how the Audacious Project works. We try and break through some of this by starting with a question that most social entrepreneurs, most people who are working for change, aren't ever asked, which is, what actually could you achieve if money was no object? Like, share with us your biggest dream. What's possible here? And it turns out that when you ask that question, you get amazing answers. You know, business operates at the scale of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars. Usually, philanthropy operates at the level of thousands or a few million dollars. That's not because the dreams aren't there. It's because of the broken funding models. So when you ask people what their biggest dreams are, that they come up with really exciting plans that can make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. we start there and we get thousands of incoming suggestions and ideas. And we have to make choices. We have to find those that have credibility behind them. There's a team who has a track record, or there is reason to believe that the intervention or the idea that they're proposing could actually work at scale. So we help those organizations turn their idea into like a five-year carefully funded and worked out plan. And we distill down to about 10 of these. Now then you can reach out to the world's busiest people with the big checkbooks and say, we have something amazing for you, something you won't have seen before. We have 10 of literally the best ideas out there for shaping the future. Will you come and meet? And we have organized like a 2.5-day retreat where people come and they look at these plans and they have a chance to dive in, and people pick the plans that most appeal to them. They dive in, they understand the details. They may have a Zoom call with the founder or the project leader. And at the end of the 2.5 days, we say, okay, it's time to decide. Will you, as a group, support this plan and this plan and this plan? And amazingly, this process works. If you like infectious generosity, one form of infectious generosity in powerful action, because someone will say, okay, I'm persuaded, I'm in, I will do it. And then the person sitting next to them says, oh, well, me too. And I've seen time and again, in 1 minute, people go in, and huge amounts of money are raised. And so the last time we did this, which was February last year, in the last hour of this retreat, more than $1 billion was committed to 10 projects. And it was incredibly exciting to see. And it's not like it was done grudgingly. The donors were sitting there, often shedding tears. I mean, they were inspired by the process. And what I learned from this, Ralph, is that you know, there's so much cynicism in the world. I mean, people think of big donors, people think of big philanthropy as just being a kind of cynical exercise in which the very rich kind of shore up their interests or they put their name on a building. That's not a general description of what is happening. There are people out there with a lot of money who are eager to give back to the public, to the public good, in a powerful way. It's really hard to do it well. And this is an opportunity for them to do it well, because the work has been done and the due diligence is there and they can come in as a group.
Let's examine this more closely in terms of the retreat in February 2023. In your book, you described some of the projects that were up for support. And I take it the creators of these projects were part of the 2.5-day retreat, right? This was all very personal, right?
Well, they're actually not. They're actually not in the way we do it, because that is one reason why things get hard. It's awkward for people to mingle with people who they feel they may have to say no to. And so
I see.
These types of retreats actually never happen. We get around the problem because, you know, I run TED and we know the power of a TED talk. We encourage each of the project leads to record a short TED talk. So that is the initial introduction to the project. And then once a group of people have said, this project actually does excite me, then we connect them over Zoom, over the internet.
Interesting. Listeners, here are four projects that got funded. One was a vision to tackle global hunger by empowering small farmers across the entire continent of Africa to increase their yields by using an effective combination of seeds, training, and financing. The second, a major new scientific institution to use the power of CRISPR gene editing to shape the behavior of entire microbiomes with extraordinary potential for both human health and our climate. Third, a bold plan to eliminate the terrible eye disease trachoma. Fourth, the launch of a satellite to track emissions of methane, a deadly greenhouse gas. And five, support to enable deworming treatment for 100 million children who otherwise risk stunted growth. So those are five. So my question is twofold. When the commitment was made to these groups, was it actually fulfilled? In other words, pledges often are not fulfilled. And second, are these projects actually underway now since 13 months have passed?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, some of those projects were actually funded earlier in the life of the Audacious Project. We've been running 5 or 6 years now. But no, absolutely. I mean, the first of those that you mentioned is an organization called One Acre Fund. The entrepreneur is Andrew Yoon. He's spoken at TED, actually. You can see him yourself to get a sense for him. But no, they have massively scaled their operation as a result of the Audacious Project donations. And Andrew will say that this was transformative for the organization and for him personally. He's still young. He's got decades of his life ahead of him. And it's flipped him from being, you know, fighting to get any kind of visibility to being absolutely determined and confident that change is possible on an epic scale. So just seeing his level of confidence and ambition grow has been thrilling. And just to take one other example, that methane satellite, which again was committed to a few years ago from the Environmental Defense Fund, that just launched about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I think, and successfully launched from a SpaceX rocket. So you've got a satellite there, it's the size of a washing machine, but it's able to track in detail methane emissions at a level of precision that allows you to identify which company's pipe is leaking. And at that level of precision, that company can actually do something about it. I mean, methane is actually a valuable gas, but it's 85 times more potent than carbon dioxide in the years immediately after it's released, heating the planet. And so it's absolutely critical that we get it under control. And companies have an incentive to do that if they know where the leaks are. And so that's been a very exciting project. And it's the kind of thing that it's hard for an individual philanthropist to do because it's a big, expensive project. But a group of people can come together and can get themselves excited about it, and it can happen.
Well, you have a section called Your Own Audacious Event, where you go down to local giving circles, which you say has convinced you that, quote, a new model of fundraising could be tried at the local level. And you give the various steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you're compiling at infectiousgenerosity.org website stories of neighborhoods that have used this approach to get things funded. And you say, if you're successful in carrying out this experiment, please tell us. We're learning from each other, and the spirit of audacity is spreading, end quote. What kind of steps would you recommend people to take? Because we're all very aware of hundreds and hundreds of local groups who can't continue because they run out of money or they can't scale up, even though in their community, as in most communities, there is a tiny number of pretty rich people who tend to be in their advanced years, pretty bored with their daily life and might want to connect in a situation that is so gratifying.
So the key mind shift here is to flip from saying, what change could I pull off on my own or someone I know, to saying, how can we create a moment of ignition, a moment of bringing people together in a way that they see each other and are persuaded by each other to do something big together? You know, we're a social species, Ralph, and this is very completely possible. So the steps I suggest there fundamentally is you start with a dinner party with some friends who are ready to dream with you. I mean, you could try and fund something directly in your community, but you could also try and do something bigger, which is to say, who out there in our community really is amazing, and if they were adequately supported, could do something super cool here. They could build a public theater or a new park or a new, you know, soup kitchen or a big art project where one is needed, or whatever the local dream is. And you then split up the division of labor, and one of you goes out to each person and tries to see if they're interested in putting together a plan, a big, bold, audacious plan. And then, this is the hardest part, you reach out to a few of the people in the community who do have resources. The first one is always the hardest, but you have something quite exciting to say to them, which is, we'd like to plan a meeting in which we're going to show you something you've never been seen before. In a single meeting, you will see 3 or 4 of the most exciting ideas that exist in this community right now, and we're going to give you the chance to be a hero. And once you've got one, you will get the next, and then they will recommend other people locally who could come. So then it's about having a meeting, perhaps at one of their homes, where you invite in the community organizers, whoever they are, and give them each a chance to make their case. And then from there, there's more than one way to go, and it depends on the circumstances there. Like you may need to dig in deeper into the project before you can actually get the ignition moment. But I think by basically bringing together those two groups, you're creating the chance for a different kind of philanthropy to happen, a different kind of infectious generosity that can bring rich and poor in a community together. It can ease some of the sort of anger and resentment that there is at the grotesque level of inequality there is in the world. And people can build something together and it can be beautiful.
Well, there's a question here. Oftentimes the people who think up these projects and know a lot about them are not very good at moving to the next stage and the next stage of connecting with donors, large or small. That's just not their area of capability. How do they find somebody who can fill that vacuum without getting caught in the matrix of fancy consultants and consultant fees
right. At
the local level?
Well, that's part of the appeal of this idea is that it's not they who are doing it. It's a group of enlightened individuals like the people listening to your show right now, Ralph, who decide that they can play this bridging role, this connecting role. It's a key piece of market making in a way. It's creating a market where there currently isn't a market, which is between the people ready to do the work and the people with the resources. And it's hard for either of those groups individually to reach out and make the connect. But a third party group that were willing to put in the time could do that. And they make it easier for people on all sides. So from the point of view of the community organizer, what you're saying to them is instead of fighting to get a meeting with one donor, in a single meeting, you're going to get connected with several. That is a huge, huge, huge gift to give someone. And to the donors, you're saying, instead of an awkward, painful single meeting with one person who you may or may not like, we're bringing you three or four of the best ideas in our community in one moment. And you'll be there with your peers. It'll be a very, very exciting moment. If it can happen at the level of hundreds of millions of dollars, I am certain it can happen at a community level as well.
We're speaking with Chris Anderson, the author of the new book, Infectious Generosity. You can go to infectiousgenerosity.org. What is the website for the Audacious Project?
That's audaciousproject.org.
Okay. Now, on page 188 of your book, you talk about the incredible agenda set out by Natalie Cargill. And I want you to talk about her agenda and give quite a few of the examples of the projects that she's putting forward. And how does she pull all this off?
So the start point here is just the notion that so much of the way we think of philanthropy is of solving depressing problems. We don't think about it as building a thrilling future. I think we should think about it as building a thrilling future. There's enough private capital in the world to dream of problem-solving ideas that can tackle basically every single thing that we worry about. You know, governments can and should do a lot, but they don't often. Companies often cause problems rather than solve them. So Natalie Cargill runs an organization called Longview Philanthropy, and I engaged in a thought experiment with her. What would happen if people with money made a pledge to give away a reasonable amount of philanthropy each year? There's a complicated calculation there, which I won't go into here, but the number we ended up with was that it's possible to imagine a world in which $3.5 trillion is made available. Now, that's more than triple what the world is currently giving away. But I think that's partly because we're giving away out of guilt and not out of excitement. We're not looking and saying, wow, the future could be amazing, and to kind of join together in celebrating possibility. So she's gone out and looked at the different kinds of things that can be done and looked at where there is an existing, credible, philanthropic approach to do it. All of these ideas in practice, execution would be incredibly hard, but she's compelling on this. And there's an ongoing debate as to some of the details, but I think it's worth knowing what the headlines are. So here are some of her headlines. One, end world hunger. I mean, today there are 45 million children who suffer from malnutrition. Two, defeat the big three public health killers: tuberculosis, HIV, and malaria. There are credible plans to tackle all of those, which currently account for basically millions of preventable deaths every year. 3, free everyone who is a modern day slave. 4, cover the costs of resettling all of the nearly 7 million refugees who currently live in refugee camps. Next, ensure universal access to basic water supply and adequate sanitation. Hundreds of millions of people in the world do not have that currently. Provide universal access to affordable and clean energy in the developing world. So there's nearly a billion people still without any form of electricity. By providing solar panels, you can do off-grid electric supply. It's transformational for people's lives. You know, there's another 20 or so of these, all of which can be done within this budget. Provide high-quality universal education at the pre-primary, primary, and secondary levels. End neglected tropical diseases. Improve maternal and child health in developing countries, saving the lives of 19 million mothers and 2 million children and newborn every year. This is a great one. Save or plant 1 trillion trees by 2050 through forest restoration and protection. Basically, that is the single biggest step to make a massive difference to the climate crisis threat. Build a system of wastewater monitoring and rapid diagnostics to detect every potential pandemic before it begins. Develop the production capacity to produce vaccines for everyone in the world within 3 months if a new pandemic breaks out. Support, this is an important one, support a safe and beneficial transition to general artificial intelligence by growing the fledgling field of AI safety to 10% of global AI investments. And there are others there, Ralph. But I mean, I found working with her and just writing down this list, there's a mindset shift that is possible, which is to actually believe that a beautiful, exciting future is not out of the question. There is a pathway there that humans could, if we collectively chose, get to.
All right, let's examine some of these from a practical viewpoint here. In past programs, we made the distinction, Chris, between charitable and justice efforts. Charitable, for example, food kitchens. Justice, making sure people all have a living wage so they didn't have to go to food kitchens. One is palliative and necessary and urgent, and the other is structural. And when you deal with structure, which a lot of your examples obviously deal with, you come up against various problems. One of them is that the big donors want more control if the efforts start challenging their other investments. The second is vested interests that don't want to change, like the fossil fuel industry. And the third are dictatorial or authoritarian regimes that don't want something like this occurring, fearing that it would get out of control and raise the expectations of their repressed subjects. So obviously the UN Development Program over the years has had a lot of these projects, and they put forth, for example, how little money it takes to eliminate global hunger. They had these goals, and then they added up the money, and, you know, compared to military budgets, it's relatively modest, and they haven't gotten very far. So talk to our audience about these practical obstructions.
The essential goal here is to say, what would a world look like where the lack of cash was no longer the bottleneck? The bottleneck is then execution. And you're right that every single one of these to actually do is extremely challenging. But in most of these cases, there are organizations who have proven that their approach can work and should be capable of scaling. There are beautiful examples of forests being nurtured and returned to health and managed properly in partnership with often the people who live in those forests to allow them to grow and thrive for the long term. It's, you could imagine, a pathway to end and reverse the loss of forests on the planet, which would be huge. I mean, none of these are easy. Look, you know, there are organizations that have done an amazing job resettling refugees and showing that they can be an asset to a society that accepts them, not a problem. So one of the audacious projects has been to support an organization called IRAP that have made huge steps clearing the legal framework and showing, you know, what can be done. And I think the biggest thing to picture here is that if this number of people came together and actually put their money towards these things, you would have a groundswell of shifted opinion that insists on progress on these questions. And governments have a huge role to play here, but philanthropy can often show the models that work. They can show governments the way. They can de-risk some of these plans. And this actually works. You know, there's an organization that the Audacious Project supported called Code for America, which showed that a few million dollars of software development could unblock billions of dollars of government aid by making it possible for people to actually claim it rather than having to go through these awful, old, clunky systems that are almost impossible for ordinary people to access. So there's no single answer to any of this. What the dream is that we get to a world where execution is the issue, but that the people who are willing to devote their resources and time to do it have the support that they deserve.
Let's go to a proposal I've made that we discussed in our conversation earlier today and see how it plays out. This was a full-page ad that I put in the Baltimore Sun about 10 years ago. And it's titled, Ralph Nader Proposes a New American Tradition, Birth Year Gifts to America. Americans born in each of these birth years, you know, 1952, 1970, can together fund their own legacy gift to lift our country's future. In other words, they would give a gift in the name of their birth year, the way college alumni classes do to colleges and universities. And this gift would be in perpetuity. It would be nonprofit. For example, when Carnegie started giving away his money, he told people in Canada and the U.S., you provide the land and I'll pay to build the libraries. And he built 5,000 libraries, which many of them are still operating. So in this proposal, I say, together, people in each birth year can advance significant self-renewing nonprofit civic institutions to improve the life prospects of our descendants, starting now. And below are some national and local examples to stimulate your imagination about what your birth year gifts could accomplish. And I give 25 examples. You know, some of them are clear justice goal, and some of them are more charitable. For example, one of my favorites is creating arboretums in communities nationwide, especially to get youngsters, not just adults, out of their screen addictions with their iPhones into nature and learning about nature formally in their schooling by going to these arboretums locally or in terms of adult education. Another example is building 2,000 community civic centers, as Carnegie did when he built his free libraries. Or another one is ending most bailouts of corporations. That's more structural and political. Another one is promoting faster conversion to solar energy and energy efficiency. Others are the ones that you've mentioned in terms of ending world hunger. Another one is organizing veterans against war, the way Veterans for Peace is doing on a smaller scale, which could be scaled up. These are the men and women who've experienced preventable war and violence. Another is creating facilities for participatory neighborhood sports. Not just spectator sports looking at TV, but neighborhood sports that are physically good for you and increase neighborhood solidarity, so-called unorganized sports. Another is making it easier to create more self-reliant communities. Another is to establish a day every year for showing up for Citizen Engagement Day to rediscover a better America. I thought Columbus Day could be replaced. He didn't discover America. He invaded America. So, and finally, another one is organizing after-school clubs for civic skills and civic experience for students in their community, real community, not virtual. I mean, just to tell you, this came out. It didn't get much reaction. I sent it to dozens of wealthy people who have signed up for the Buffett-Gates Pledge. And I talked about it on a significant number of radio and TV programs, but it didn't clinch. So it failed so far. So when I read your book, I said, this is manna from heaven. There's got to be a much more practical and effective way to do it than I've been able to think up. Take it from there, Chris.
So what this idea has in common with what I've been writing about is the shift of mindset from a single donor can do to pulling together a group of people who are united by something. Your idea is that year of birth is a powerful thing. If I heard that there was a group who were born in my year of birth was 1957. If I heard that there was a group of people born in that year who were planning beautiful dreams for the future of the world or the future of America or of a community, I would be tempted to join because, oh, well, you know, that's my year. And then, you know, that group could see if they can agree on something that they're all excited about. The challenge with all these ideas is how you get them to critical mass. Like, you need to find, like, people won't just respond to an ad, I think, or to the idea in its raw form. What they need is to know that someone is actually, or some group are already on the march, so to speak, that there's something happening and it's clear what their role can be. And so I wonder, just looking at, well, it's almost like connecting your idea, Ralph, with some of what I wrote about in the book around a local audacious project, whether there's a way of tweaking your idea so that it's done slightly differently. Because this idea done nationally, you'd have to figure out a way of, say, persuading everyone born in, you know, your birth year, let's say, of, what was that, 1934, to come together. And how would that happen? You know, maybe you could get a bunch of people on Facebook or something like that, but it's quite hard to imagine. What I can imagine more easily is for a group of retired, quote, I hate the word retired, by the way, I think of it as, like, I want to advance, not retire. I want to advance from the idiocy of working for someone for all those years to controlling my own life. It's advancement, not retirement. But anyway, those people in a community to come together where they can actually meet in person. So take this idea of yours of creating arboretums in communities nationwide. Arguably, people would be more motivated by the notion of an arboretum in their community than the concept of arboretums nationwide. And so if you persuaded or could persuade or set up the seed of, come on, advanced / retired people in a given community, come and meet and do a bit of dreaming about what you could contribute to that community and pick, say, five of these ideas that are best applied to communities, arboretums or new local library or some other local service that people could get excited by, and try it at that level. And there you've got a group of people looking at each other who could say, you know what, I'll do this if you'll do this. And I think a great number of people to meet is, it doesn't have to be a big number, like a dozen people, anything from like 6 or 7 people up to about 20 is almost the perfect number because it's small enough that decisions can get made and people can act together, but big enough that you could pool resources and still dream of something pretty interesting. So I don't know, I think you're onto something quite big here, and it's just about tweaking the form of it until you can picture a way of sparking some examples of it. Once it's been done a few times, it can spread.
Taking off from what you just said, listeners, a lot of part of this book is talking about the desire to give and the rewards from giving. Not material rewards, but rewards of being significant and contributing to the common good. We might call them psychological rewards. And Chris points out that lower income people give a higher proportion of their income to charity than higher income people give in terms of percent of their income and wealth. So there is that psychological incentive to be part of something beyond the normal getting through each day after day with all their problems. So let me just ask you this. How do you get people to desire to give? And how do you get people who don't like to ask people for money to ask people for money?
Yeah, it's a big thing. It's so crazy that, like, people who are very wealthy, what is the purpose of hanging on to the money? I mean, your choices are, one, you know, you die and you do nothing with it and ruin the lives of your children, who then, I mean, there's so much science showing that you know, too much inherited wealth is destructive of people's mental health and effectiveness. There are just so many stories of inherited money that has gone wrong. So that cannot be a smart goal. You can leave your kids with something so that they won't, you know, they're not going to be thrown out into the streets, but let them build their lives. You build yours and create your legacy. So that's one thing, is just being smart about not destroying your own kids' lives. The second thing I'd say is just knowing how there's more and more scientific evidence of how deeply generosity is built into people. Like we do not feel satisfied unless generosity is part of our lives. It's a weird thing because it's sometimes hidden a bit from us and you don't actually feel it until you've done it. But the deepest pathway to meaning and happiness flows through generosity. It doesn't have to be giving away huge amounts of money. It may be giving time or knowledge or other things, giving artistic beauty or so forth. But having that as part of your life, that is essential to, it's one of the essential ingredients of happiness. And so it's worth knowing that. And then thirdly, I'd say just that we're in an age where what we do impacts what other people do. We're a social species, we're connected like never before. Your generosity won't just have its direct effects, it will have ripple effects because other people will respond to it. So for all these reasons, it is one of the most important questions people can ask is, how do I do it better? How do I find the right form of generosity that I can best contribute? Because if you can get an answer to that question, it can be transformative for how you feel about yourself and certainly for the people around you.
Well, you make an important point. Generosity is way beyond just money. It's time, advice, experience. It's a retired lawyer, a retired doctor, for example, providing counsel to local neighborhood or community groups. Sometimes they make connections, they help networking these groups. So it's always good, I think, when you ask people for money to ask them for their advice, their time, their networks, the benefits of their experience. And oftentimes that way you can actually raise more money than if you just ask them for money. As you point out in your book, there's the tithing tradition among Christians. There is zakat, tradition of giving among Muslims. All religions have their strong recommendation that people who can should contribute to needs of their friends and neighbors, people who live in their communities. So I hope it does get translated in a lot of languages because you speak a common language in every page of this book. Steve?
Chris, this is probably unfair, but whenever I see the name of somebody on a building, a theater or a museum or something, I'm always wondering, okay, what horrible thing that they do to get their money that they're trying to atone for? And so my question is kind of along the lines of what Ralph was talking about, palliative versus structural. With philanthropy, don't you run up against people who aren't really interested in changing the system that made them rich? Aren't there limitations to all of this?
So this is such an important question. You know, we're in an era where there's not a good thing that anyone can do without it being challenged. And often, you know, with some reason. My own belief is that almost every act that anyone does has mixed motivations, that we're complicated people. I think a lot of the rich want to, I mean, look, I've had many conversations with many of them over many hours, and I believe that many of them are sincere in their attempt to want to give back, but they may also want to have a good reputation out there in the world. And I think we kind of need to get past having this expectation of perfection, a perfection filter. You know, if there is any possible hint of an alternative motive, then we get to condemn that act. That is a recipe for, one, cynicism, two, nothing ever getting done in the world. I think we should take the opposite stance, actually, and say, can we find some signs of good motivation? If so, what the hell? Let's celebrate that. We want to give people every reason we can to have more generosity, not less. So, and especially, you know, in the connected world. So for the person with their name on a building, I say, yeah, okay, you got your name in a building. That's nice. I bet you also were being a bit generous. And it's, thank you. This is actually a lovely building. I'm glad that you spent the money. You know, it's just a lot more joyful to be celebrating the good parts of what people do than tearing down the bad parts. That's my belief. Enough of perfection.
David?
Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
David?
So I'm not trying to discount the great work and righteous ideas you and Ralph are promoting, but philanthropy to me sounds like trying to reinvent the wheel, and that wheel would be government. For example, here in America, 2 years ago, we had Build Back Better and the Green New Deal, which would have transformed our social safety net, our economy, and the planet. But the entrepreneurial class, who set up their own charitable foundations, blocked those two bills because they don't want to pay their fair share of taxes. So my question for you and Ralph is, despite all its flaws, at the end of the day, isn't government the most cost-effective way to get all this money where it's needed? Shouldn't we be more concerned about a more judicious and democratic tax code that allows the people to decide how all this money is distributed, especially since, unlike the Ford Foundation or the Bill Gates Foundation, nobody in the government gets paid $500,000 a year, except for maybe Dr. Fauci?
I've got several answers to that, unless you want to go first, Ralph. But I mean, I don't think it's either or, right? I'm all for fairer taxes. I'm all for the rich paying more in tax, frankly. And good luck with that. You know, that's a long journey to get that to happen. While you're campaigning for that, what do you want to happen? Do you want them, just their private capital, to continue to pile up? Or would you rather that they were actually spending the money? That's one response. Two, when you actually look at government's track records, it's very mixed in terms of actually getting things done. I mean, what do you want to look at? Look at NASA compared with SpaceX. Might be one provocative example in terms of actual achievement per dollar spent. Or look at the example I gave of Code for America. So there was a bill in California that allowed for food aid to a large number of people, and several billions of dollars was put aside for this. But to apply for it, you couldn't do it on a mobile phone. You had to apply for it on a computer. Many of the people who needed it didn't have computers, so you'd have to go on a bus trip to a library. There you would sit in front of a computer and go through 49 pages of questions, some of which were inconsistent with each other. If you couldn't save your work, so if you couldn't get it done in the hour it took to do that, then you had to start again another day. It is no surprise that a huge percentage of this budget was never unlocked, and philanthropy paid for a revision to the application process that could be done on a smartphone in 5 minutes and locked billions of dollars of money. So it's not either or. It's philanthropy has an incredibly important role to take the risks that the government isn't willing to take, to show what is possible, and to, in some cases, advocate for governments to be bolder or to do things in a certain way. It's not either or. So I think, you know, humans are capable of doing more than one thing. We're capable of fighting to give government its due recognition, while also acknowledging that there's an incredible amount that private capital can do as well.
Two other points. Philanthropy that is structural, it raises people's expectation, David, which could be transferred to government performing at a higher level of public interest instead of being corporatized. The second is that trying to develop a core of advocacy starting in government, which is already entangled with corporate interests and corporate officials in government and campaign money, is very difficult. Whereas if you start the way we did, we didn't have to compromise our mission, such as in auto safety, for example. So we started on the outside, and it was a nonprofit effort to demand that government regulate the auto companies for safety, pollution control, and fuel efficiency on the inside. So it's not just not either or, it's also a sequence of civic energy getting government to do what it should be doing, which is not servicing Wall Street, but servicing Main Street, or servicing the people who sent legislators to Washington in the first place. Anna?
My question is about the scalability issue. I've worked in nonprofits. I've left a lot of nonprofits behind. A lot of people who have experience in the nonprofit world or in grassroots organizing may say that by scaling up any sort of social activity, it actually becomes less effective and fuels a nonprofit industrial complex that concentrates decision-making power and money into fewer pockets and creates sort of a hegemony where people like Bill Gates decide what projects are deemed worthy of funding. And there are tax breaks for the uber wealthy. And that, in fact, the economies of scale that corporations benefit from don't actually apply the same way to social projects. What would you say to that criticism?
I would argue the exact opposite. I think the reason why parts of the nonprofit world are not effective is because they haven't been given a chance to scale. So many things work best at scale because you can bring down costs, you can increase brand awareness, you can make it easier for large numbers of people to collaborate with each other. I mean, the best thing that ever happened at TED was we gave away our brand, and that allowed tens of thousands of people around the world to produce their own local events. They did it because of the scale, because people had heard of TED. And so it made it easier for them to recruit speakers and so forth. There's so many things that happen well at scale. And most of the value in the for-profit world comes from large companies. And yeah, we love to hate them, but we all depend on them. We spend hours streaming Netflix or using our iPhones. And those things only work because they've been allowed to get to massive scale. I think the nonprofit world needs scale. And where it's had scale, that's where it's been most effective. I mean, you took a shot at Bill Gates there, and no one's perfect. That foundation is very powerful. Occasionally, it can have maybe a chilling effect on other ideas. But they have played a key role in reducing the number of children who die every year from preventable diseases from 12 million a year to below 5 million a year. They played a key role. And it would not have happened that fast without it. And it's been possible because they've been able to operate at scale and get out, for example, some of the vaccines and so forth that have made a massive difference. So that's 20,000 children who didn't die yesterday because of the action of a foundation operating at scale. I think the argument's completely upside down, Hannah. I'm sorry, I disagree with you on that one.
Well, there are also dark sides to the Gates Foundation, like most giant, powerful institutions, which we have alluded to in prior programs. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We've been speaking with Chris Anderson, the author of the new book, Infectious Generosity, full of examples, full of projects, and full of actual accomplishments to the principles that he talks about here. He's actually networked and arranged for these proposed projects on a large scale getting funded. So if you want to know more about it, go to infectiousgenerosity.org and more specifically, theaudaciousproject.org, theaudaciousproject.org. Before we conclude, is there anything we haven't touched on you'd like to make to our listeners, Chris?
Just that, thank you for the time. You know, we've been talking big money. None of it starts there. That the simple thing that anyone can do is just give attention to someone else for a minute or two. Just see someone. We're in a world where no one feels seen anymore. And just starting by taking a drip of gratitude that you feel about your own good fortune and turning your attention to someone, listening to them, that's where it all starts. Any of these other ideas, you know, they all start from that little gift of a gift of attention. That's where everything begins.
That's where democracy begins, too. One, two, three, four people, eight people, they're off. Thank you very much, Chris.
I'm sure this is
a subject that will be continued to be explored on other interviews that you give around the country.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Chris Anderson. We have a link to his new book, Infectious Generosity, at RalphNaderRadioHour.com. Now let's check in with our corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokyber.
From the National Press Building in Washington, D.C., this is your Corporate Crime Reporter Morning Minute for Friday, April 5, 2024. I'm Russell Mokyber. A troubled heart pump that has now been linked to 49 deaths and dozens of injuries worldwide will be allowed to remain in use despite the Food and Drug Administration's decision to issue an alert about the risk that it could puncture the wall of the heart. That's going to report from the New York Times. The tiny Impella pumps about the width of a candy cane are threaded through blood vessels to take over the work of the heart in patients who are undergoing complex procedures or who have life-threatening conditions. The FDA said the manufacturer of the device, a biomed, should have notified the agency more than 2 years ago when the company first posted an update on its website about the perforation risk. For the Corporate Crime Reporter, I'm Russell Mulcahy.
Thank you, Russell. Welcome back to the Ralph Nader Radio. I'm Steve Scrovan, along with David Feldman and Hannah and Ralph. And that's our show. I want to thank our guest again, Chris Anderson. For those of you listening on the radio, we're going to cut out now. For you podcast listeners, stay tuned for some bonus material we call the wrap-up, featuring a little bit more with Chris Anderson and Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard. A transcript of this program will appear on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour Substack site soon after the episode is posted.
Subscribe to us on our Ralph Nader Radio Hour YouTube channel. And for Ralph's weekly column, it's free. Go to Nader.org. For more from Russell Mulcahy, go to CorporateCrimeReporter.com.
The American Museum of Tort Law has gone virtual. Go to TortMuseum.org to explore the exhibits, take a virtual tour, and learn about iconic tort cases from history.
We have a new issue of the Capitol Hill Citizen. It's out now. To order your copy of the Capitol Hill Citizen, Democracy Dies in Broad Daylight, go to CapitolHillCitizen.com.
And remember to continue the conversation after each show. Go to the comments section at RalphNaderRadioHour.com and post a comment or question on this week's episode. We might not like them all, but we read them all.
The producers of the Ralph Nader Radio Hour are Jimmy Lee Wirt and Matthew Marin. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky.
Our theme music, Stand Up, Rise Up, was written and performed by Kemp Harris. Our proofreader is Elizabeth Solomon. Our associate producer is Hannah Feldman. Our social media manager is Stephen Wendt.
Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, everybody. As always, be active.
Hi, this is Jimmy Lee Wirt, and welcome to the wrap-up, where Ralph continues his conversation with Chris Anderson.
Well, the Bridgepan Group was the advisor to Mackenzie Scott, the former spouse of Jeff Bezos, who has already given away almost $15 billion of the amount she got after the divorce from Bezos, the founder and head of Amazon. And I found that until recently, Chris, it was impossible to reach them. She's a graduate of Princeton, as I am. She graduated from Hotchkiss in Connecticut, where I grew up. And I had all kinds of suggestions for them, and they weren't taking any suggestions. They didn't even have a website until after they gave away maybe $10 billion. And it was impossible to get through to the Bridgepan Group. I got through to someone in San Francisco, a lower level, very nice person. Told me who to call in Boston, could never get Mr. Hussein in Boston. Now, in your book, you say, quote, the key is for both nonprofits and donors to work with each other more creatively, more courageously, more collaboratively, end quote. How do they do that if they can't make contact?
Right. So it's definitely the case that anyone who has a significant amount of funding is deluged with a lot of incoming, and it's very hard for them actually to reach out to everyone. And I think a lot of people in that position feel quite guilty about that, but they just don't want to spend their whole time on email or on the phone. And so it is a challenge. I mean, how do you fairly allocate resources?
Now, before we go to Steve and David and Hannah, we sent some weeks ago by one of our colleagues, Hamilton Fish, a proposal to your TED Talk office in New York called the Democracy Trust. And it reflects a lot of what you are urging. It scales up civic energy for a more just society to a much, much greater level than current progressive consumer or environmental or worker advocacy groups do. And it deals with structure a great deal, and not simply palliative. It deals with structural change, shifts of power, and focusing on the decision makers in the public sphere, like state legislatures, city councils, and Congress. So I hope you look at it and talk with Ham Fish about it, because in many ways, it's multiple nodes touch on a lot of the points that you make in this book titled Infectious Generosity by Chris Anderson. And before to go to Steve, have you been interviewed by NPR or public broadcasting yet?
Let's see. I think I was on a show that also was on NPR, but I've certainly not been interviewed like this, Ralph. This has been great.
Yeah. Have you been covered at all in Canada?
Yes, CNBC did do an interview, yes.
And Globe and Mail might do a good treatment in one of their high-level Sunday editions, the leading newspaper most people would call it in Canada. What about translations into other languages?
The book is in about, I think, 20 countries at this point, 20 other countries or languages. It's definitely meant to be an idea for everyone.
Yeah, I would think it would do well everywhere.
And now, Hannah comments on quote-unquote outrageous salaries for CEOs of nonprofits.
Why do you say outrageous? I mean, how is it, you know, we're in a society where an effective CEO of a company impacting a million people can be paid a seven-figure salary, whereas someone leading a nonprofit organization that impacts several million people may get $300,000 or $400,000 as a salary?
So by outrageous, I mean one of my hobbies is looking at 990s of nonprofits because they show executive compensation. For a while, I liked to look up the compensation of the CEOs of nonprofits where I'd worked, and I'd had these people sit down and refuse a, you know, $2 per hour raise, and they get $500,000 a year because the market determined the quote unquote the market rate for an executive is $500,000 a year. So when I say outrageous, I mean the ratio between CEO and the average worker in nonprofits, a lot of the times is maybe not as bad as some of the highest paid CEOs in the private sector, but is pretty.
I just think it's, you've got to say compared to what? I mean, sure, the difference between what a worker is paid and what a leader is paid in organizations is unfair. In the for-profit world, by the way, in America, that ratio is 350-1 right now. I don't believe it's anything like that high in the nonprofit world.
And now here's In Case You Haven't Heard with Francesco DeSantis.
In an airstrike, Israel killed 6 foreign aid workers, including an American citizen, along with their Palestinian driver, Al Jazeera reports. These workers were affiliated with Chef Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen, which had been doing what it could to fill the gap left by UNRWA after the U.S. and other Israel-allied nations pulled the organization's funding following dubious claims about UNRWA workers colluding with Hamas. On Twitter, Andres wrote, quote, "These are people, angels. They are not faceless. They are not nameless. The Israeli government needs to stop this indiscriminate killing and stop using food as a weapon," end quote. Israel claims that striking the convoy is unintentional, with PM Netanyahu saying, quote, "This happens in wartime," while smirking in a video message. World Central Kitchen CEO Aaron Gorin, quoted in the Washington Post, maintains that this strike was, quote, "a targeted attack," end quote, by the IDF, and called the strike unforgivable. The uncommitted electoral protest movement continues to pick up votes in Democratic primaries nationwide. In Missouri, uncommitted took nearly 12% of the vote statewide and over 20% in the 1st Congressional District, represented by outspoken ceasefire advocate Cori Bush, per St. Louis Public Radio. In Maine, blank ballots, that state's version of an uncommitted ballot line, took over 10% of the vote statewide, a tenfold increase from 2020, per political blogger Ettinger Mentum. More troubling for the Biden campaign are the polls nationwide and in swing states that show widespread discontent with his handling of Israel's murderous rampage. A recent Gallup poll shows that a majority of Americans now disapprove of Israel's campaign by a margin of 55% to 36%, the result of an 18% drop among Democrats and independents and a 7% drop among Republicans. The same poll shows that only 27% of Americans approve of the president's handling of the situation in the Middle East. And in Wisconsin, a new poll by Poll Progressive Strategies finds that 1 in 5 Wisconsin Democrats say Biden's handling of the war in Gaza will impact their vote in November. 71% say they strongly support an immediate and permanent ceasefire, including a stunning 100% of voters under the age of 29. In 2020, Biden won Wisconsin by 0.63%. In another sign of how out of step the Biden administration has become with the liberal mainstream, Patrick Gaspard, president of the Center for American Progress, former executive director of the DNC, and former ambassador to South Africa under Obama, has issued a stinging rebuke of the State Department's claim that Israel is upholding international law in Gaza. In a statement, Gaspard writes, quote, "The State Department's shocking assertion that the Netanyahu government is complying with international law in Gaza is a gross disregard of overwhelming evidence and a dangerous precedent in the conduct of U.S. foreign policy. The United States cannot heedlessly deliver offensive weapons as the Israeli government continues to bombard and starve innocents on a mass scale. These actions have nothing to do with self-defense. They are clearly intended as collective punishment and are resulting in the complete devastation of Palestinians as a people." As Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman continues his unpopular turn to the right, a wave of resignations has rocked his office. The Philadelphia Inquirer reports the senator's deputy communications director, Nick Gavio, resigned last Friday, with his departure coming on the heels of the resignations of Fetterman's former communications director, Joel Calvello, and press and digital aide, Emma Muschin. Calvello decamped for the office of progressive Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, while Gavio is taking a job with the Working Families Party, per the New Republic. As if escalation in the Middle East were not enough, the United States is now deploying Green Berets to Taiwan, the Asia Times reports. According to this report, quote, U.S. Special Operations Forces have been permanently assigned to Taiwan's frontline islands, preparing elite Taiwanese units for possible island defense and guerrilla warfare operations against the Chinese invasion. U.S. troops on Kinmen will be situated just 10 kilometers from mainland China. Quote, this outrageous provocation would not be tolerated by the United States, of course, but any response by China would surely be labeled as aggression in the Western media. This whole exercise is rendered especially preposterous as the U.S. recognizes Taiwan to be part of China under the One China policy, according to the State Department. Morningstar reports so-called Medicare Advantage has been overbilling Medicare by approximately 22%. This figure comes from a report issued by the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, or MedPAC, an independent body set up to advise Congress on Medicare in the 1990s. MedPAC's new report titled Medicare Payment Policy reads, quote, "We estimate that Medicare spends approximately 22% more for Medicare Advantage enrollees than it would spend if those beneficiaries were enrolled in FFS Medicare, traditional Medicare, a difference that translates into a projected $83 billion in 2024, end quote. As Morningstar puts it, quote, the private insurers who now run more than half of all Medicare plans are overcharging the taxpayers by a staggering $83 billion a year. They're charging us taxpayers 22% more than it would cost us to provide the same health insurance to seniors directly if we just cut out the private insurance companies as middlemen. It's a ripoff, pure and simple. We've previously discussed on this program how President Biden is urging Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO, to help stem immigration coming up through Mexico. In a recent interview with 60 Minutes, AMLO laid out his conditions for doing so. Quote, the U.S. must commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. The U.S. must lift sanctions on Venezuela. The U.S. must end the Cuban embargo. And the U.S. must legalize law-abiding Mexicans living in the U.S. This proposal sounds more than reasonable. A moving story in Atmos Earth details the movement among Polynesian indigenous leaders to extend legal personhood to whales, considered their mythological common ancestor. In addition to legal personhood, these advocates are pushing for, quote, the establishment of rahui, or customary marine protected areas, to reduce harmful impacts from threats like trawling and ship strikes, and empowering coastal communities as kai taiki, or guardians, end quote. If enacted, this would be a major shift in the legal landscape that would help preserve the planet's marine ecology as it comes under greater and greater threat. Finally, in less uplifting animal news, the Iowa Capital Dispatch is out with a report on private equity's impact on veterinary care. According to veterinarian Melissa Ezell of Huntsville, Alabama, vets are increasingly, quote, feeling pressure from management to make a certain amount of money from each appointment. If a pet owner wasn't going to spend enough, the message from management was to offer more services. She was urged to pack in more patients outside of normal business hours, end quote. This clinic is, quote, owned by National Veterinary Associates, one of the largest veterinary chains in the nation. In 2020, the company was acquired by JAB Consumer Partners, a global private equity firm based in Luxembourg. Private equity firms such as Shore Capital Partners, KKR, TSG Consumer, and JAB Consumer Partners have spent billions over the past few years on veterinary practices, specialty animal hospitals, pet insurance services, and pet food companies. Among the companies owned by private equity are PetSmart, PetVet Care Centers, FIGO, Thrive Pet Healthcare, and ASPCA Pet Health Insurance, end quote. This story may sound familiar because it is the private equity playbook they have run on industries ranging, quote, from nursing homes to car washes, end quote. And being the same playbook, we know how this ends, with the philosophy of profit maximization leading to predatory pricing and a reduction in the quality of services. So if you don't want companies like JAB Consumer Partners controlling your pet's health tomorrow, take a stand against private equity today. This has been Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard.
And that's a wrap. Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Until next time.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.